You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the President of the United States called out Ted Cruz and all these right-wing wacko birds who say that he's trying to undermine America, that he's a tyrant-in-chief. They've been calling him all kinds of names. They say that he's trying to tear down the institutions of American democracy. Here is what he had to say last night.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Wrong president. I don't think that President Obama... We heard last week that he was going to give a speech focused on income inequality. Then the National Journal. This is fascinating. Divided Democrats put Obama in a State of the Union squeeze. This was published on January 20th. Josh Krauchar. And he says, as the White House drafts the sixth State of the Union address, signs of strain are emerging within the Democratic Party, with liberals pushing the president to be more outspoken about the economic issues that now drive voter dissatisfaction. But the that's what the liberals want, right? But the party's centrist wing, where do they come up with this language? The party's centrist wing, which generally backs entitlement reforms, where do they come up with that language? They don't want entitlement reforms. They want to cut Social Security and Medicare and free trade agreements that appeal to the more affluent. Well, that's an honest statement. Wants Obama to use the speech to convey an economic growth message. The liberal wing is more confrontational, is urging a more confrontational approach toward Wall Street and higher taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Third Way President Joe Cowan and Senior Vice President for Policy Jim Kessler last month arguing economic populism is a dead end for Democrats. Well, it looks like the president's listening to the Third Way. His speech last night, this is a guy who can give a hell of a good speech. And last night was not one of them. It just wasn't. There was no Harry Truman. There was no Franklin Roosevelt. There was no John Kennedy in there. Clip number four here, Shane, there were a couple of cute moments. And in fact, if you think about the Republican State of the Union, the official Republican response, they had a woman give the response. Now, when men, give speeches, they usually do them behind a podium. They do them standing up. Now, I don't think Bobby Jindal or Marco Rubio had podiums, but they were standing up. And they weren't, in their living room. But the little lady is in the living room sitting on the sofa where all little ladies should be, right? This was the Republican response. Circa 1960. She looked like Betty Crocker. I mean, I suppose I mean that as a compliment. She did a great job of smiling throughout the speech. I mean, just television 101. So apropos of 1960, here's the president from his speech, which preceded the Republican response.
It is time to do away with workplace policies that belong in a Mad Men episode. This year, let's all come together, Congress, the White House, businesses from Wall Street to Main Street, to give every woman the opportunity she deserves because I believe when women succeed, America succeeds.
Now, that was one point, one moment, I think, of really significant contrast between the president saying that and pointing out that women are still earning 73 or 77 cents, whichever it is, for every dollar that a man earns. Between the president saying that and the Republicans delivering their response with a woman sitting on a couch in her living room. And behind her, did you notice the stars behind her? Behind her, there was this weird triangle, and the stars were all flipped upside down. I'm guessing it was a folded flag. And it was folded to show the stars, but they had positioned it in such a way that the stars were flipped upside down like the Republicans did on their logo, which is the satanic star. If you didn't see that, I was, you know, through her whole talk, I was so distracted by that. I mean, I kept waiting for her to say something like, here's our actual suggestion. She never did. But I kept looking at those stars going, why does she have satanic stars over her shoulder? In any case. So, you know, the president gave a speech, and he called for closing Guantanamo. He said, we're ending the war in Afghanistan. That's good, although, you know, how about pointing out that we never had to have a war in Afghanistan or Iraq, that they were mistakes, that they were crimes? I mean, this soldier up in the gallery gets this, like, the longest standing ovation, just goes on and on and on. The guy got blown up on his 10th deployment in Afghanistan. So that George Bush could get enough political capital that he could privatize Social Security. You would think that the president would call out the Republicans on these things. Or you would think that he would point out that he has been, you know, that the Republican obstruction, that the conspiracy that was hatched, that Newt Gingrich came on this program. Newt was in the meeting. He came on this program and said, yeah, I was there. And that's what we did. January 20th, 2009, as the president is dancing with his wife over at Union Station, Ellen Ratner and I were there. His inaugural ball. As that is going on, 10 blocks away, 12 blocks away at the Caucus Room restaurant, in a private meeting room, you got 15 Republicans getting together and planning to bring down the Obama presidency. We sweat, and then, you know, and then we had another one of these meetings right after his second, you know, inauguration. This one, this new one was chaired by Ed Meese. The last one was chaired by Newt Gingrich with Frank Luntz there. And in both cases, it was, we're going to block absolutely everything he does. And you heard all the clips yesterday. I played a whole bunch of Harry Truman clips yesterday. I'm not going to do it again. But Harry Truman called that stuff out. And I don't know why the president didn't. And I don't know why he didn't. Well, actually, I do know. It's because the Supreme Court has said that money is protected by the First Amendment. And every politician in Washington, D.C. is now terrified of the billionaires. I mean, remember originally this was supposed to be a State of the Union about inequality? And then the billionaires started calling the White House and saying, yeah, you don't talk about inequality, please. He used the word three times. He never once mentioned the consequences of inequality. We'll be back in just a minute. 15 minutes past the hour. Your thoughts on the State of the Union, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I thought, and no mention of a card check, no mention of unionization. I guess the one good thing is he didn't overtly push for TPP. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Andrew Campbell with us, senior producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So we're going to start out with a fairly long rant that's basically my version of the State of the Union.
Yeah, you'll be going over what President Obama glossed over. And as you were saying right before the break there, he only mentioned inequality three times. And really, when he did mention it, it wasn't anything of substance. There weren't any suggestions on how to fight the inequality epidemic in America. So you'll get into that a little bit in your rant, touch on some other issues that the president may have overlooked but are just as important for getting our country back on track.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. And then the Lone Liberal Rumble, Kyle Peterson and Jesse Jane Duff.
Yep, it should be a good one. We'll be talking about your rant, and we'll actually present your ideas to the Rumblers and see what their take is. We'll be talking about undoing the disastrous Citizens United decision, and isn't it time to get money out of politics? We'll also be touching on rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. Last night we actually talked about how tax cuts don't help the economy. They hurt it, so isn't it just the logical thing to do to roll these back and make the wealthy elite in America pay their fair share to support the country? And we'll also be touching on gun violence. There was actually another shooting during the State of the Union last night at Tennessee State University. Kind of ironic, and it really highlights the gun epidemic that's going on in our country right now.
Yeah.
And then we'll finish off by talking about a carbon tax and when we can get one of those in place in the U.S.
It would be a fine thing.
Yeah.
It would be a fine thing. I mean, you know, every other industry pays to take out the trash. I still don't know why the oil and gas industry doesn't. Actually, the one high point for me, now that I think back on it, about President Obama's speech was when he said, why are we giving $3 or $4 billion a year in tax breaks to the oil industry and not to to renewables? That was the one moment where I thought, wow, you know, he actually said something. Okay, anyhow, tonight we're going to follow that. We're going to follow that with the bold progressives.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the sort of what came out of the State of the Union and what didn't in regards to the progressive movement in America. We'll have on Adam Green. He's the co-founder of Bold Progressives and the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. And we'll also have Shayna Bellows on. She is a progressive candidate for U.S. Senate. In Maine for the seat that is currently held by Susan Collins.
All right.
And I'm sure she has some very interesting ideas on what needs to happen in America and the progressive policies that need to be put in place, so we'll get into that.
Do you know if she is post-primary? She's the actual candidate who's going to go up against Collins?
I believe she is the actual candidate that will go up, yes.
Okay, cool. And then Good, Bad, and Ugly, and basically our daily take about how the Republican conspiracy has worked, what I was saying before the break.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We'll just get into a little more on that.
Yeah. So it'll be a good one.
Should be good, Joe.
And we've got a crazy alert tonight.
Yeah, we have a pretty funny crazy alert tonight. It's actually, you have a take on it, but it's basically talking about how the upside-down star and the goat's head are satanic symbols. If you watched the Republican response last night, you saw those in the back of the congresswoman's screen. And there's a little more to it, so we'll get into that.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, Andrew Campbell. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to have you with us. We'll be back. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Professor Harvey Kaye with you, Professor of Justice and Democracy, Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay, author of the forthcoming book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, and also author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, Brilliant History of the American Revolution. His website is twitter.com/HarveyKaye, Harvey J.K., right?
Right.
Okay. Professor Kaye, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here, Tom. Absolutely great.
It is always great to have you. And I mentioned your book on Thomas Paine, not only because I think it's one of the finest, you know, books on that era, and it's a great way of understanding the American Revolution and the post-revolutionary period and all that kind of stuff. You know, Paine was arguably one of our most important founders. But also today is Thomas Paine's birthday.
Absolutely. Happy birthday, Thomas Paine.
There you go.
January 29th.
There you go. And any idea how old he would be today?
You know, I should have calculated. 277, let's see, 1737, is that 200?
He'd be moving kind of slow.
Yeah, right. Slowly, right. Well, you know what? It's pretty cold out here in Wisconsin. I'll excuse myself with that.
Yeah, there you go. It's pretty cold everywhere. I mean, it's this global warming thing weakening the jet stream so that it's allowing polar air to slop.
Thomas Paine vein and the weather vein, I can tell you that I was down this past weekend, as I do every year, celebrating Paine's birthday with Florida Veterans for Common Sense in Sarasota. And it's a great bunch of guys, a progressive group of guys. We had 150 to 160 people turn out for the dinner party. The amazing thing was that there I was in Sarasota thinking I had an escape from the chill of Wisconsin, and the temperatures there had to be 20 to 30 degrees below what I was hoping for.
Whoa. Yeah. Yeah.
Not that anyone should feel sorry for me. It was wonderful, and it was great to celebrate Paine's birthday again with the vets.
Yeah. So tell me, Professor Kay, what would Thomas Paine say about the President's State of the Union speech if he were alive today?
I can't help but say I think he'd be actually terribly disappointed. I think that what would strike him in particular is that going into this speech, President Obama spoke of the necessity for us to do something about the gross inequalities of wealth and income in this country. And I'm sure Obama thought hard about it and decided he was not going to go where Thomas Paine would have gone, because what Paine would have done is not only challenged that inequality, he would have called on Americans to join him in challenging that inequality. He would have called upon Americans to rise up, make noise, organize, and mobilize. It was hard to hear a president from the Democratic Party practically begging capital America to give a wage, as opposed to saying it's time to organize labor and ask for the justice that we are due.
Or demand the justice. Yeah, I mean, he was saying...
No, exactly. I mean, it was just astonishing. And, you know, the thing about Paine is he implanted, you know, when he wrote Common Sense and the Crisis, he sort of endowed us with, he imbued us with the sense that we Americans are really the governors of this nation. And I think what's worrying is to consider the fact that we elected a president in 2008, we reelected a president in 2012, constantly hoping that he really did mean, yes, we, capital we, can. And over again, it's a matter of beseeching the Republicans or the conservative rich to do the right thing.
Yeah. You know, he said he's gonna work with CEOs to try to get wages up. Really?
Yeah, there wasn't a single mention of labor. There wasn't a single mention of popular action. I mean, it was astounding. And what Thomas Paine was about was speaking to his fellow citizens, putting into words their aspirations, unspoken aspirations, and really turning what was a colonial rebellion into a revolution for a democratic republic.
Right.
And I think Paine would be in pain. I think he would be utterly disappointed in what he heard last night. And I'd like to think that Paine and I are on the same wavelength.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt in my mind that you guys, that you're probably the reincarnation of Thomas Paine.
Well,
to give the president, to cut him a little bit of slack, we no longer have a democratic republic here. Now that the Supreme Court has asserted absolutely, and particularly over the last 40 years or so, ever since Lewis Powell was on the court in a big way. I mean, it was 38 years ago this week that we had the Buckley case.
That memo, and also that memo he wrote just before he got onto the Supreme Court.
Yes, yes. And which I just wrote a book about.
I know that is a wonderful book. Everyone should read it.
Thank you. And that what we have now is a constitutional monarchy. I mean, there is not a single monarch in the developed world that has the power to strike down laws or to invent doctrines out of whole cloth and put them into law, a power that the Supreme Court has asserted, even though it's not found in the Constitution. What would Paine say about that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of a democratic republic is that the people govern, right?
Yeah.
That they assert their authority, that when they elect their representatives, those representatives are accountable to the people. Now, there were no polls, P-O-L-L-S, at the time of Paine's writing, but we know from polls and surveys just how much Americans want to address this question of inequality in power. They want action. Now, the question now is not what Obama will do. The question is, what will we do? What will we hear from Richard Trumka? What will we hear from the leaders of what remains of a civil rights movement? What will we hear from the leaders of consumer rights? When are we going to rally around some common purpose, a democratic purpose, and demand that we reclaim the heritage, the legacy right. that Thomas Paine afforded us?
And I would like to start by amending the Constitution to say that money is not protected by the First Amendment and corporations are not protected by the 14th Amendment.
Absolutely. I second the proposal.
Okay. Professor Harvey Kay, Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, author of the forthcoming book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, and the previous book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. I have the title right, right?
Right, and I look forward to our next conversation.
It's been a couple of years since I read it. It's an absolutely brilliant book. Today is Thomas Paine's birthday. Thank you, Harvey.
Okay, bye-bye,
Tom. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If you want to read a really, truly brilliant history of America's founding, read Harvey Kay's book on Thomas Paine. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. 27, 28 minutes before the hour. Shane was just telling me when a military funeral happens, the flag gets folded up and put into this little triangle and given to the people. And apparently that was the flag behind the Republican congresswoman. And so I shouldn't have gone off all paranoid about the flag, the stars being upside down, because that was just, you know, the way it was supposed to be. So let me correct myself on the air. Back to the speech. Yesterday we were playing Harry Truman clips. We have some Barack Obama clips. I mean, here, clip number three, he says climate change is a fact. I mean, there were some bright moments in the speech. This is another one. This was, clip number three. Here, listen to this.
The shift to a cleaner energy economy won't happen overnight. And it will require some tough choices along the way. But the debate is settled. Climate change is a fact.
Yeah, there you go. And he made a good remark about, trying to blow up Obamacare 40 times, that we've already litigated that. This is clip number seven. The president had this to say.
But I know that the American people are not interested in refighting old battles. So, again, if you have specific plans to cut costs, cover more people, increase choice, tell America what you do differently. Let's see if the numbers add up. But let's not have another 40-something votes to repeal a law that's already helping millions of Americans like Amanda. The first 40 were plenty. We all owe it to the American people to say what we're for, not just what we're against.
There you go. So, there's a few high points, but by and large, it was not. None of us probably remember. I'm guessing anybody who's old enough to remember these speeches is no longer with us. But back in the day, this was 1936 in Madison Square Garden, the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, speaking about the folks that Elizabeth Warren is trying to take on, that this president in his speech last night decided, even though 2 weeks ago he said he was there, the White House was suggesting that he might take them on, decided not to take on. This is the President of the United States back in 36.
We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
Now, what's wrong with saying that, right? Obama could have said that, and you can hear the applause in the background. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. You want to hear a really long applause line? Listen to the applause line following this one.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
And then comes the applause. And then the next part of the speech is like a really cool part. We're going to get there, but people went nuts. I mean, you know, I didn't see President Obama getting any kind of applause lines like this last night. Of course, the State of the Union is a little more distinguished than this was a campaign rally in 1936. But actually, it wouldn't have been a campaign rally. It would have just been a speech. Because 36 was not a presidential election year, was it? 32? 36? Yeah, it was a presidential. So this was a campaign rally. Yeah. So anyhow, here then he says... Now, first of all, he says they hate me. Now he says I got these guys. I got them.
I should like to have it said of my first administration that in it the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their match. I should like to have it said. Wait a minute. I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it. These forces met their master.
In other words, I just kicked their butts right across the room, and I did it for the last 4 years, and I was president of the United States, and I'm running to run to be the president again. And this was, keep in mind, by 1936, FDR had cut unemployment in half from the Republican Great Depression. In fact, he called out the Republicans continuously for causing that Great Depression. It's really, you know, quite remarkable what he had to say. In fact, I think I've got this, he's talking about, you know, for 12 long years, right? He's talking about the Harding administration, the Coolidge administration, the Hoover administration. For 12 long years, America suffered as a result of these Republican administrations. For 9 years, actually, there was this phony prosperity, and then 3 years of the Great Depression, 1929 to 1932. He's talking about this time.
For 12 years, our nation was afflicted with hear nothing, see nothing, do nothing government.
And, you know, yes, everybody got it. Hear nothing, do nothing, see nothing government. And that's what the Republicans are doing right now in the House of Representatives. Well, we're not even going to meet. FDR continues.
The nation looked to that government, but that government looked away. Nine mocking years with the golden calf and 3 long years of the scourge.
The scourge.
9 crazy years at the ticker. And 3 long years in the breadline.
Get it? I mean, it's like Obama could have been talking about the Bush Depression last night. He didn't.
9 mad years of mirage and 3 long years of despair. And my friends, powerful influences strive today to restore that kind of government with its doctrine that government is best, which is most indifferent to mankind.
Which is basically, you know, Rand Paul's philosophy.
For nearly 4 years now, you have had an administration which, instead of twirling its thumb, has rolled up its sleeves.
Indeed. And he did.
And I can assure you that we will keep our sleeves rolled up.
There you go. So, anyway, let me pick up some of your calls and your thoughts on this. David in Occidental, California. Hey, David, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? David, you are on the air. David is not Not on the
Hello?
Air. David, yes, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm calling because you keep talking about how Harry Truman ran against the do-nothing Republican Congress.
Right.
And you say that that was the last time the Republicans controlled the House until Newt Gingrich. And that's not true. When Eisenhower was elected, he was elected with a Republican Senate and a Republican House. And that's the last time the Republicans controlled the House.
1952,
they gained control. Of course, it was 53-54 that they ruled. But
Are you sure of that?
I'm positive.
Okay,
I can even tell you that the Speaker of the House, his name was Joseph Martin Jr.
Uh huh.
He was the same Speaker of the House that happened in the 46 election. When the Republicans
so they came back. So that was 52 and 54, or just 52?
Well, it was the election of 52, so they ran the House in 53 and 54, and then the Democrats took over in 55.
Okay.
And ran it until Newt Gingrich.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you for setting me straight, David.
And I just have one other correction to make for you.
Feel free.
And that is about the bonus army. The bonus army did not happen when Franklin Roosevelt was president.
No, it started under Herbert Hoover.
Right. And I've heard you say that Roosevelt looked out the window and saw the bonus army.
No, my point was that when Roosevelt came into office, the bonus army was out there.
Well, they weren't out there because in the last part of July of 1932 was when Hoover had the tanks come down the roll through the Capitol and
take them out.
A couple people and
right. Okay. Well, thank you for correcting me on that too, David. It's good to have an accurate history.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that had there not been a bonus army, I think FDR would not have had a lot of the power that he did.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more and your thoughts on the President's State of the Union right after this. And welcome back, Diane in San Jose, California. Hey, Diane.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being so clear about Obama.
Well, let me dial this back just a little bit. I've been playing Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt campaign speeches, and President Obama last night gave a State of the Union address. The State of the Union address is, by definition, much more sedate. On the other hand, he did have an opportunity to call out these folks, and he suggested to us that he was going to, and then he didn't. So that was.
I know. I was so disappointed. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine just came over a couple of days ago, and she said, "Diane, because she doesn't drive, she takes a bus. She says the whole park, one of the parks, was filled with homeless people." Mm. So I like to. It's made me really sad. The analogy before I work with homeless people. In fact, she's homeless. So the fact, though, that a whole park, and this is in San Jose, near City Hall, is filled with homeless people.
Hmm.
Just, I don't want to say it breaks my heart, because I'm getting really angry now. I'm getting angry.
Yeah.
I couldn't even bear to listen to his speech. Because
it wasn't that bad.
Well, I know, but when you're listening to the wonderful speeches by Truman
Well, again, those are campaign speeches. President Obama has given some real barn burner campaign speeches too.
You know, Tom. Just I'll let you go. I just want to say there's a whole lot more than a million homeless people. There's 3,000 homeless people in San Jose. I think it's insane when buildings, and a friend of mine who's a retired teacher said, do you know how many buildings, there's a lot of fires that have been set, I don't know who's setting the fires, These buildings need to be cleaned up, cleared up. The banks are just letting them go to waste.
Yeah, there's empty houses all over America. No, I'm with
yeah.
you.
And who's addressing that?
Yeah, no. To the best of my knowledge, nobody. Diane, I want to get Mike in here from Seattle. Thanks for the call. Mike in Seattle, listening on KBCS. Hey, Mike, we got a minute to the break. A quick one about McRogers, Congresswoman?
Yes, in the Daily Kos, there's an article, Some Truths About Kathy McMorris Rogers. Apparently, she was not always an orchardist. She actually came to Canada until her second year in high school, where her father rented an orchard. And it goes on from there to show that her father was the chair of the Republican Party in Kettle Falls in that county, and that many of the things she says are basically a story, and they also made up that she was a pioneer on the Oregon Trail.
Hmm. You mean in her family somebody was a pioneer on the Oregon Trail?
Well, she claims that, but
okay.
That the
your first sentence, you said she was not always, and then that word dropped out. What? She was not always a what?
She was not always an orchardist.
I'm sorry, say that again? No. Not always a what?
An orchardist.
An orchardist. Oh, okay. All right. Thank you very much. Not a word I've heard in a long time. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. With you and David in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I was just listening to your show, Ed, and I heard the caller that tried to correct your point on the Congress being Republican.
Right.
And in your book, The Crash of 2016, which I'm now reading, you did make the correct point in there that during a brief period of time under President Eisenhower that they were Republican.
Right.
But it was only such a brief period of time. It had no real, you know, influence or anything like that. And President Eisenhower many times did not side with the Republicans.
Yeah, in
and
fact.
His final address, you know, you did mention, too, about the statements he made about the military and that and the complex and that.
Right. And he, in fact, there was a lot of speculation in 51 and early 52 that he was going to run as a Democrat. And he probably,
yeah.
you know, had the mood of the nation been, let's elect a Democrat, he probably would have run as a Democrat. I think he could have done either one because he was one of those politicians who really did represent the center, as it were. And
with a tax on the wealthy, about, what, 91%, I believe I read?
Yes, the top income tax rate was 91% at that time. And he maintained, and that was maintained up until the Johnson administration. LBJ dropped it down to 74%. So. Thanks a lot for the call, David. I appreciate it. Michael in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Michael.
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. Tom, real quick here. I just finished 2016. Very, very scary book. Absolutely a necessary read. And I'm glad that there's a glimmer there, a light at the end of the tunnel that you pointed out.
Oh, I think there's a huge one. And we have, this country has always, through every crisis, we've always ended up better. And that's the good news. The book ends with, you know, a very positive note. But you wanted to talk about the State of the Union address.
Right. Well, I gotta tell you, my disappointment came in that there was really nothing very much said outside of talking about like minimum wage and everything about working Americans, about certainly labor. I'm organized labor, so yeah, you know, you can color me that color, and all. It just didn't come across, you know, for me on my end, and you know, I'll figure myself as being progressive like you.
It was not an activist speech. It was a kind of classic Democratic Party speech in my mind. Which is not a terrible thing. It's not. I'm not saying that this was a bad State of the Union address. I thought he gave a very good speech. It's just, you know, I was hoping for more. And frankly, there was a debate apparently a few weeks before that he was thinking of giving us more.
Those rumors were said, and you know, a lot of hope there. I hate that. No, but I will let you go. The only other thing I just did want to say that it's incumbent upon us to, you know, keep information flowing, like, and you do such a wonderful job. Thank you for, you know, a Free Speech TV and everyone that's on there too. So we have to, now in particular, this has to be one of those mid-year elections where we really have to turn up the heat in terms of progressives. I've just unaffiliated out here in Colorado. Of course, I'm like Bernie Sanders. I caucus with the Democrats now.
Yeah.
And all, and I will. And I'll knock any of the bad ones, you know, certainly in their place. But everything that was said last night just didn't come across as hopeful for me. And the other side, just their inanity. They were so inane in what they were talking about.
Well, I think the congresswoman did not actually say anything. I mean, I heard a whole bunch of platitudes. It was a Betty Crocker speech. And maybe that sounds sexist. Who would be the male equivalent of that? Casper Milquetoast? It was a Casper Milquetoast speech. There was no there. It was a whole bunch of platitudes. Anyhow, Michael, thank you for the call. Arthur, in Homewood, Illinois, you want to defend President Obama and you think it's disgraceful for me to compare FDR to him?
Obama's speech. I'm asking you, why would you compare him to one of my best presidents, Roosevelt? We had some darn good Democrat presidents. Roosevelt,
right.
Truman, they were great.
Yes.
Kennedy. But I left the Democrat Party in 1967. These guys, they worked with the rich. They worked with the people. They put people to work. They didn't cut their throats or hit them on the head with a 2x4 because they're 1% Koch brothers. You know what? In 1967, right here in Chicago, the Communist Party took over the Democrat Party, and that's when I left the Democrat Party. But to compare Obama with President Roosevelt's speeches is a disgrace, sir. And I'm telling you, it's a big disgrace, because that was he was my only president I knew. I was born in 1929, and for 16 years, he was the greatest president to me, because I was... And here, then Truman came along.
So wait a second. If the communists took over the Democratic Party and Obama is a Democratic president, you know, the communists were that's what FDR was accused of being, was a communist. You know,
no, he was not. No, he was not. He was for the working man.
Oh, I know that. You know that. But the Republicans accused him of being a communist. If the communists, in your mind, took over the Democratic
Party, I don't like. See, I'm not a Republican. I'm strictly. A conservative, period.
Uh-huh.
Okay? I don't like these. I didn't like McCain at all.
Right. So you're of the opinion, I'm just trying to understand this, you're of the opinion that FDR was one of our greatest presidents, and you call yourself a conservative, presumably like a Barry Goldwater conservative?
Was conservative? Very conservative.
Yeah.
You know what? I never forget the time he made in the speech. He said, you know what, how we got to increase... And I was, like I told you, I was in the food business. And I would tell a customer, you bought a pot roast, how would you like this or how would you like that? In other words, speak up and try to sell them something else. He said, I go to a store, buy a package of razor blades, and that's all. And they say, anything else? Instead of suggestive selling,
right.
That's gone.
Right. Okay.
That's why we're in a hole we are.
Yeah.
Does not take care, don't know how to talk to their people.
Okay. Arthur, thank you for your opinions, and thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back. It is, actually, we're going to be back with Professor Donald Boudreau, maybe it's Boudreau, senior fellow with the Mercatus Center, or is it Mercatus Center? This is one of those libertarian think tanks. It should be a very interesting conversation. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Professor Donald Boudreau, am I saying that right, Professor?
Yes, you did.
Thank you. Professor of Economics and former chair of the Economics Department at George Mason University. And you were referred to us by the Mercatus Center, which says that you are senior fellow and Nelson Getchell chair for the study of free market capitalism. Do I have that right?
That's right.
Okay. The president last night, I was hoping that he would call income inequality the defining challenge of our time. He didn't. He mentioned the word inequality three times, once in relation to income inequality, although he did not even preface it with the word income. Why would you object to saying that income inequality that is right now standing at levels that we have not seen since 1929 is a bad thing?
Because I don't like raising envy into public policy. There's nothing in any theory that I know of or any ethics that I know of that says that dictates that incomes have to be equal. People make different lifestyle choices. People have different levels of luck. Demographics change. And I dispute, actually, the claim that income is that income differences are at levels more and equal since 1929. It's true if you look at pre-tax and pre-non-cash transfers. Once you include the taxes and the transfers, then it evens out, and we're at levels of post-tax, post-transfer income levels that are much more equal than they were in the beginning of the Great Depression era.
Because in 1929 there were no food stamps, there were no welfare programs,
Medicaid,
earned income tax credit, those kind of things.
Right.
And the top tax rate was at 25%. Well, actually, in 29 it was at 25%.
Yeah.
And right now it's at 39%, although most of the genuinely wealthy people pay their income taxes at the 20% top rate as capital gains. You're opposed to envy. I don't think that most people who are concerned about income inequality are motivated by envy, and why would somebody be envious of somebody having $50 billion as opposed to $1 billion, or as opposed to having $200 million? I mean, I look at the research that was done by Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkerson over in the UK when they published the book Why Inequality Matters, and then the more recent The Spirit Level, and what they found was that the more unequal a country was, and they looked at the 34 OECD nations, and then they looked at the 50 states in the United States, and what they found is that the more unequal the distribution of wealth was, the worse all your social indicators became. You had more teen pregnancy, you had more venereal disease, you had more mental illness, you had more homicide, you had more suicide, and the less unequal, in other words, the more equal a nation was or a state is, the better outcomes you have. You have longer lifespan, you have less teenage pregnancy, you have less drug addiction, you have longer lasting marriages. I mean, all these things, they have like 30 different social indicators that they were able to really clearly measure.
That research has been, I think, pretty justly criticized. I mean, look, numbers, you can torture the data and find and get them to confess almost anything you want. But that research has been subject to the criticism that they didn't get their causality right. Now, a lot of the things they point to are that might themselves be the results, themselves be the cause of greater income inequality rather than the result of income differences. There was a report that I read a few days ago by Scott Winship at the Manhattan Institute, pointing out that if you the greatest in the United States, the greatest single indicator of a lack of income mobility is not income inequality. It's whether or not you are raised in a two-parent or single-parent household. And so, you know, we can cut and slice and cut the data in a lot of different
ways. But that's, I mean, you know, correlation and causation. The single-income household may well be the consequence of the poverty associated with the income inequality.
Or it could be the cause. This is the problem.
But what if it's both?
It probably is.
Then shouldn't we do something about that? Shouldn't we try to lift those people out of poverty? If there is a circle there, if there is a cycle there that poverty produces single parent families and single parent families produce poverty, how do you break that cycle? You can't break that cycle by saying you're living in poverty. Therefore,
I think a discussion about poverty should be done separately from a discussion about income inequality. That's a different discussion. We can talk about how deep poverty is and about what are the appropriate policies to handle people in.
But is not poverty a symptom of income inequality?
Not necessarily.
I lived in Europe for a year, and the countries that
income inequality. If everyone's rich, but you have really super rich people, the two are not the same.
Yeah, I know, but what I'm saying is, in the countries where income inequality is quite low, in Norway, and Sweden, and Denmark, and Finland, in Germany, and France, you don't see the kind of deep poverty that we have here in the United States. You just don't see it.
But that might not be the result of that could be the result of other factors.
I think it's the result of the fact that in every single one of those countries, the top income tax rate is well over 50%.
Well, I disagree. I don't think that you make people richer by make poor people richer by taking money from the rich people and
Then why is it that the northern European countries and Australia and increasingly some of the South American countries or parts of them, parts of Brazil, for example, as they raise taxes on the very wealthy, and as they raise the floor underneath the very poor, as they strengthen the social safety net, they see improvements in all these social indicators and a decrease in single-parent families?
I haven't studied those countries, but I think you know one thing that I'm going to say, because most people on my side say it, and I think there's some validity to it. I think there's a great deal of validity to it. A lot, particularly in the Scandinavian countries, number one, they're very homogeneous. They're much smaller than America. You have a very homogeneous population. Number two, those countries score on indexes of economic freedom much higher than America in many ways. They have a lot less burdensome regulation. They don't all have minimum wage legislation. And so they have higher tax rates than we do. You're certainly right about that. On other fronts, they have less intrusive governments. And so it's hard to pinpoint where the benefits are coming from, whether it's coming from the higher taxes.
I'm astounded to hear that. I mean, these are countries that are part of the EU. They're operating under the precautionary principle. I would love to have the levels of regulation that Norway has.
If you like a lot of regulation, then you might not. You might want to take that back, because you'd be surprised to learn the not on every,
no GMOs. Right.
What does that have to do with income inequality?
Well, it's regulation. I mean,
well, look, they have some regulations we don't have. We have some regulations they don't have. But they have, like, for example, Sweden. Sweden has school choice. I forget which of the countries. I don't think all three, but at least one, perhaps two, have no minimum wage legislation. For example, they don't have anything equivalent to the Davis-Bacon Act.
They probably don't need it. I mean, you know, Norway's got the equivalent of the Alaska Permanent Fund. I mean, they've got this massive pile of cash from the North Sea oil that they basically hold as a you know, social security for everybody in the country.
Well, if that were a key to wealth, and some sub-Saharan Africa, then Nigeria would be wealthy too, because Nigeria has such a thing.
Well, no, they've got a corrupt political system there.
You need good social institutions.
Yeah. Okay. Professor Donald Boudreau, professor of economics and former chair of the economics department at George Mason University. Interesting conversation. Thank you for dropping by today.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So could it be that income inequality is not a bad thing? I'm not convinced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And what is this? Christy in with the Capos? I don't know what this is over at the Huffington Post. Anyhow, 15 minutes past the hour, and Randy watching Free Speech TV in Smock, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV and for calling in. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. I just called to say I was very disappointed last night. You know, he puts me in mind more and more like George Bush by saying, we are going to rely on incentives to get the private sector to hire. Why can't he be like Roosevelt in 1934 when he said, quote, if the private sector of America can order or will not hire tens of millions of Americans who have no jobs, there is no alternative but to have the government hire them.
Right. This is what I've been saying. This was the Democratic Party platform from 1944 when Roosevelt gave his second Bill of Rights speech and suggested that a job should be a right. The Democratic Party platform from 1944 until 1988 called for the government to be the employer of last resort. They abandoned that. The Democratic Party abandoned that in 88 because, Reaganomics was so popular. It was, the seventh year of the Reagan administration. I guess they just figured, okay, we're going to roll over and play dead or something. But it's like, I don't know why they don't go back to it.
It seems like year after year, it seems to say that the private sector demonstrates to all of us the enormous vertical strength of its middle finger. He never says that.
Yeah.
He never tells the truth like that.
Yeah.
But that's what they're doing.
I think you're right. I think you're right. Randy, thank you for the call. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? Rick? Rick is watching his TV rather than listening to his phone. Let's see here. Skip in Highland Park, Illinois. Hey, Skip, what's up?
Tom, first of all, I got to tell you, you are the breath of fresh air. Not a breath of fresh air, but the breath of fresh air.
I think there's a few others out there, but thank you.
Number two, a gentleman called about four or five callers ago and said that during the Eisenhower's administration, he had a Republican Congress.
Mm-hmm.
It was incorrect. The first 6 years were Democratic. I can read it to you verbatim off the Internet.
The first 6 years of Eisenhower's presidency?
The first 6 years was Democratic.
In the House of Representatives.
Republican Eisenhower was able to achieve numerous legislative victories despite a Democratic majority in Congress during the first 6 or 8 years in office.
Huh. I'm going to have to go back and look this up because then,
I was in college at the time and I was very, I've been a political junkie all my life and I remember specifically about that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I'm not challenging you and I'm not challenging the earlier caller because I haven't had an opportunity to look it up. I had always... I don't know. But I'll have to look it up. But Skip, thanks for, are you suggesting that the last 2 years of the Eisenhower administration, he had a Republican House of Representatives?
That's what I'm reading.
Interesting.
Quote, Democratic majority in Congress during the first 6 of his 8 years in office.
Right. I wonder though if it was the House or the Senate, because I thought it was the House that it just went that way all that time. But anyhow, I'm gonna have to look it up. Skip, thanks a lot for the call. Now you got us all scratching our heads. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Steve in Los Angeles listening to KPFK. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi. Yeah. President Obama, he makes these speeches that sound very progressive about income inequality,
mm-hmm.
and yet his actions are, about a 180 from, what his words are. I was listening to an interview around the beginning of January with Michael Greenberger. You familiar with him?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't know.
He was a director of some department within the Commodities Futures Trading Commission.
Right. Okay.
And this interview was with Ian Masters, a background briefing on KPFK. And he was just saying how Obama's appointees for the commission are extremely regressive. The ones that are in there now have been pretty good trying to battle it out with Wall Street.
Right.
And he's letting the head of it go, and he's appointing someone else and appointing a couple other people, and they're extremely regressive.
And I think this is a very scary sounding
interview.
Yeah,
what could happen because of this.
And what I think we're seeing here is the influence of money on politics, in this case with the Democratic president. The Republicans are the wholly owned party of the rich. The Democratic Party is the half owned party of the rich. And both of those are not good things for American democracy. And they are both the consequence of the Supreme Court hatching this doctrine out of thin air that money is somehow protected by the First Amendment. And I don't see the word money anywhere in the First Amendment. And that corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment. And I, to the best of my knowledge, Abraham Lincoln did not fight the Civil War to free the corporations. And the 14th Amendment was passed, you know, as part of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed to free the slaves and give rights to former slaves. And
The strange thing is, in the interview, he was saying that a lot of the people that are leaving were, a couple of them at least, and the head of it, were Bush appointees, and they've been very aggressive trying to fight Wall Street and put in regulations.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know the minutia of the CFPT or whatever, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. But I do know that, you know, with the FCC, with the, you know, with a number of different agencies, President Obama has, and I mean, look at his Secretary of Defense now, Chuck Hagel, started out as a conservative talk show host, and then he became the CEO of a voting machine company. And then when Nebraska started, you know, taking votes on his company's voting machines, he ran for the Senate and won. And but he was a Republican through all that, right? A very conservative guy. And he's the Secretary of Defense, which is pretty amazing when you think about it, from right-wing talk show host to Secretary of Defense. But although Chuck Hagel seems like a reasonable guy, but still, it's like, I think that the reason why Franklin Roosevelt could pull it off and President Obama can't, and I don't think it's that he won't, I think it's that he can't, is because the Supreme Court has given so much power to billionaires and transnational corporations. And they've done it with these two doctrines, that corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment and that money is protected by the First Amendment. And, you know, they 38 years ago this week in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision was when they, you know, finally came out and just said it out loud that money is protected by the First Amendment. And 4 years ago last week was when they tied these things together in this nice little bow with Citizens United. And the president referenced last night how, you know, the Supreme Court has, he didn't call out the Supreme Court by name, but he said, you know, the Civil Rights Act has taken a whack, has been weakened. Well, that was the Supreme Court. That was the Roberts Supreme Court. Sam Alito was not there to say not true because he just doesn't show up anymore. And neither does Scalia, neither does Thomas. But anyhow, Steve, thanks for the call. It is a problem. Angel in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Angel, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to point out, Tom, about the Representative McMorris for the GOP response and how she's, you know, for less government, smaller government, but was shocking to hear that her father was a school bus driver, a good union job. Her mom, a librarian, you know, good union job. Her husband's in the military with generous benefits. She works for the government with generous benefits and was willing to shut down the government, make sure that those that had these government jobs didn't have an income, while herself and other elected officials kept their pay. We should talk about that and how, you know, due to the fact that she had good government jobs provided, you know, for her family, and that's what got her to where she's at right now. It's just, it's amazing, and nobody's really talking about that.
Yeah. Well, and I haven't had a chance to get to it. I'm scrolling through right now to see where it is, but perhaps her biography is not quite the way that she characterized it. But that's interesting. There's a picture over at the Daily Kos. Republicans finally have to face Obamacare reality. I want to learn a little more before I go off on a rant about this. I'm gonna hold back on this. But,
sure.
But
when I saw the response, I was just like, okay, she just named off, her father, her mother, they're public sector workers, and her husband's in the military, and she's an elected official. So
they're all taking their money from the government, and then she's condemning the government. Is that your point?
Exactly. Last but not least, I just want to make sure that if we do get proper immigration reform, we got to make sure that NAFTA's tied into it.
Yeah, or the NAFTA is undone. I'm with you on that. I mean, NAFTA is a large part of why we had so many people immigrating to the United States. It's, that and the corn subsidies that are, wiping out subsistence-level farmers down in Mexico. Angel, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to 92.1 FM there in Madison. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's a remarkable time we live in. We'll be back. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very lithophagously ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good. The American solar industry. 2013 was another banner year for American solar energy companies. According to the 4th Annual National Solar Jobs Census, the U.S. economy added more than 23,000 solar-related jobs last year, raising the total number of solar jobs nationwide to over 142,000. Solar Foundation, the group that conducted the study, says that it expects a similar rate of growth in years to come. Countries like Germany have been pushing solar energy for years. It's good to see that America is finally catching up. The bad. Representative Randy Weber. On Tuesday, the Texas congressman had the less than glorious honor of being the first Republican lawmaker to call President Obama a socialist before the State of the Union address. While waiting for the president to take the podium, Weber, sent out this tweet. On floor of House, waiting on Commandant-in-Chief, a socialist dictator who's been feeding us a line. Or is it a lion? L-Y-I-N-G. End of quote. Yep, that's right. The president, who touted the benefits of free trade deals during his State of the Union address, is a rampaging socialist dictator. It's ridiculous. And the very, very ugly Peter Schiff. The CEO of Euro-Pacific Capital is under fire today for controversial remarks he made about the minimum wage during an interview that aired last night on The Daily Show. Schiff told interviewer Samantha Bee that it was okay to pay a mentally challenged person as little as $2 an hour because wages should match how much someone is worth. Check it out.
If we eliminated the minimum wage law, then individuals would be free to accept jobs at whatever pay they're able to get.
Give me a picture of a person whose work would be worth $2 an hour.
You know somebody who might be? Maybe somebody who is, what's the politically correct word, for... mentally retarded. What's the new? The,
okay.
That's what I believe in, the principles that the country was founded on.
But
I'm not going to say that we're all created equal.
I don't know what's worse, that Schiff thinks exploiting disabled people is okay, or that he thinks that is what our country is founded on. It's very, very. That's bizarre. Okay, so the president gave his State of the Union speech last night. The State of the Union is, it's a hell of a lot better than it was under George W. Bush. You have to say that. It's a hell of a lot better than it would have been with George Romney as president, or with John McCain as president. I mean, those were our options, right? If McCain was president, we would be opening a war right now with Iran. And if Romney was president, Social Security would be run by Goldman Sachs. Or maybe Bain Capital, you know, who knows. But anyhow, Patsy in Pismo Beach, California. Hey, Patsy, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to take exception with that man who said, you know, that Sweden doesn't have a minimum wage, which is true. But, you know, this is becoming a right-wing talking point. This is about the third time I've heard it. But what they don't bother to add is that the reason Sweden doesn't have a minimum wage is they have labor unions, trade organizations, guilds that, you know, negotiate the wage with the employers, and then the employers have to pay that wage. So as a result, Sweden has an average about $30 an hour.
Yeah, isn't Sweden something like 80% unionized? Hello? Patsy? Yeah, Patsy? Isn't Sweden like 80% unionized? Isn't the unionization rate really, really high there? Patsy can't hear me. Okay. Don in Maricopa, Arizona. And thank you, Patsy, for the call. Don, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. You wanted to talk about inequality and our guest at the top of the hour?
Yeah, I disagree with this professor. People are not jealous because folks are wealthy. People are angry because these folks have an advantage with their money. They're able to influence politicians, in some cases buy them. They influence the Supreme Court, in some cases encourage them to come to secluded meetings so that they can discuss. Now, we don't know what they're telling them or what they're promising.
But we do know that they're paying them.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Either they're paying them with money or they're promising them something after they're in their retirement.
Right.
But people are not jealous. Americans want fairness. They want a system where they can trust their politicians, and we cannot trust them. You know, we sit here every day and listen to politicians talk about stuff about where the workers is wrong for not being able to find work. Personally, I'm retired, you know, but I have a sympathy for those who are struggling trying to put food on the table. We got politicians like the Republicans just cut the food program, SNAP, but they turn around and give large subsidies to wealthy folks. So that's the inequality that we got. We got inequality in our leadership.
Yeah,
our leaders don't understand that we need people in Congress that's going to pass laws that protect us all.
Yeah.
You know, I hate NAFTA. And I look at Bill Clinton, the voice of NAFTA when it was sold to us, and I looked at the jobs. And it was Ross Perot who told us that the jobs are going to be sucked up out of here. And it was sucked up out of here. And we're still struggling. And now we got the TPP coming down the pipe, and a lot of folks don't know about it. They are not informed of what that will do. We should have a broad campaign right now of people's movement, calling their congressmen, complaining about not changing the whole system here. That we have to have people in office who respect everybody, not just the wealthy.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you very much, Don, for the call. I think that, you know, I think this is the place where FDR said it, that government by organized money is as bad as government by organized mob. Let's find out.
For nearly 4 years now, you have had an administration which, instead of pulling its thumbs, has rolled up its sleeves.
Now, that's not it. Maybe it's right here.
To their own affairs. And we know now
there we go.
That government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
Yeah. And this is what the last caller was talking about. Tom in Oklahoma, that town?
Shoto.
Shoto, thank you. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind? You wanted to talk about...
Well, I just listened to the program, Tom, and I just wanted to kind of make a brief statement in defense of whoever this gentleman was talking about employing the mentally and physically...
Handicapped,
say, yeah. Impaired, whatever word is politically correct nowadays.
Right.
Many years ago, right after I got out of college, I was in charge of a sheltered workshop for the... severely and profoundly handicapped. This is people that couldn't even work in a sheltered workshop environment.
Right.
And the way these people were paid for what they did was based on what they produced, needless to say. And the way this was done, we would set up samples of able-bodied people to do the same tasks these people were required to do. And and set that at a prevailing wage at that time. This is back in the mid-70s.
Right.
And then these people would produce whatever the task was that the average able-bodied people had tested, and then they were paid according to their percentage.
Right. Pay them a piece rate based on that.
Made more. It just depended on what they were able to produce.
Yeah, and there's some dignity to that kind of work. But there's what Peter Schiff was suggesting was that might be how your income is defined. And I get it. You know, if you've got somebody who otherwise has a decent life, in other words, their food and shelter and other medical needs, all these things are being provided for them, then giving them work to do that pays very little, but it's some work that they can do so that they can have dignity, is actually a good thing.
Oh, yes.
But if this is their sustenance, and in fact, we have laws that allow for that. But on the other hand, if this is how they literally pay for their living, then that's a very problematic thing. And Schiff is one of these super free market guys who thinks that we shouldn't have, I believe, I've heard him speak a number of times, who is not a fan of the social safety net. And so you would end up with people like that who are mentally disabled, living, you know, not only making $2 an hour, but living on $2 an hour. And you can't do that.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. Well, yeah, that's no good. No,
yeah. But, and that's
my point. Of course, I probably misunderstood this man's premise or what platform he was actually speaking from. But those kind of programs do a tremendous service, as you said before, in giving people at least a modicum of a self-respect and dignity and achievement.
I agree.
In a free society.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And that can't be their income. I mean, that's more like this is your
exactly.
your fun money. This is your money to go to the movies
with. Society has to somehow supplement their income, of course. Yeah, I agree with that.
Right. And that's where we part company with the libertarians and the conservatives who think that folks like that should be entirely dependent upon public charity or private charity rather, and or wealthy benefactors or families or whatever, and it just isn't always possible. So Tom, good point though. Thank you for the call. Well said. 15 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. We'll be back. Broadly, we're talking about the President's State of the Union address, although the question of inequality is also on the table, and pretty much anything else you want to bring to the table.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It'd be very interesting to find out, you know, what the difference in perspective was between, for example, boomers and millennials to the speech last night. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carrie in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Carrie, what's up?
You talk to me, Tom?
I am. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
I was saying if that shift or whatever his name's economic philosophy was true, shouldn't the members of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives be making about 25 cents an hour for what they're producing?
Based on productivity? Maybe. Maybe.
All right.
It's a good point. Okay. Thanks a lot, Carrie. That was a good one. Ernest in Waldron, Arkansas. Hey, Ernest, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
We are supposed to have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And we have a government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations.
Yeah, I would say corporations and billionaires.
Yes.
And the billionaires that they spawn.
The government has been printing billions of dollars. Almost like the Weimar Republic did in Germany after World War I, which to me is a Ponzi scheme, especially to older people like us who are on Social Security, and the government says we're about 2 or 3% inflation, but in fact it's about 12 or 13. As a consequence, our standard of living is disintegrating.
Yeah, I agree with your point that the way, and Bernie Sanders makes this point almost every week on this program, that the way that cost of living adjustments, COLAs for Social Security, are calculated needs to be different than the inflation index, because the inflation index is based on you know, everybody, not just retirees, and retirees are spending a lot more money on food and medicine and shelter. And the fact that iPads are going down in price doesn't help them at all, you know, or iPhones or whatever. But you know, the Weimar Republic intentionally deflated their currency because after World War One, the Treaty of Versailles imposed this huge penalty. Basically, you know, the Allied countries got together and said, we're going to make Germany pay for all the damage of World War One. And John Kenneth Galbraith said at the time, he said that if the Treaty of Versailles is signed, it will lead to the next world war. And he was absolutely right. There was no way that under the Treaty of Versailles, there was no way that Germany could come up with that much money without just impoverishing its people. And so, you know, first they started impoverishing their people, and the people started rebelling against that, and the government fell. And then, you know, the government then just said, okay, instead of doing that, we'll just start deflating the currency. We'll start printing, you know, more and more German marks. And, you know, because we've got to pay back a trillion German marks. So, okay, cool. We'll make it so that a trillion German marks equals a loaf of bread. Here, France, here's your trillion marks. And this was their way of getting around the Treaty of Versailles. It didn't work all that well, and it led to the rise of Hitler, and it was a mess. But the original sin, I think that Galbraith correctly identified it, was the Treaty of Versailles to begin with. Now, America's not doing that right now.
Yes. Quite frankly, I think you should be on a major network that the corporations would never allow the truth and opinion of a very learned man such as yourself.
Well, thank you for your kind words, Ernest. Although, let me say, I think Free Speech TV is a major network, and I'm very pleased to be on it. And you know, they've got quite an audience. We've got a lot of people watching. So, Ernest, thank you for your kind words, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, working in South Sudan. You can check it out at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. But hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, other things going on than the State of the Union, though we may get to that. The mammoth $956 billion farm bill passed the House today in a bipartisan vote.
Oh, this is with an $8 billion cut to food stamps over a 10-year period, right?
It is an $8 billion cut, but it's not the $39 billion cut that House Republicans wanted.
So it passed the Senate?
It's probably going to go to the Senate tomorrow. It passed the House today.
Passed the House, huh?
Passed the House today, and this is where it's been held up.
Right.
It's been really stuck.
Right.
So this is actually a big deal because it's actually been stuck for 3 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, we've been without a comprehensive farm bill for 3 years.
Now, I understand that they also dialed back things like benefits to Michelle Bachmann.
They did to a certain extent. There's two things I want to mention. One is the provision whereby people who are not farmers but have been getting payments as though they were farmers are no longer getting them. And thank Senator Chuck Grassley taking the lead on that, along with some others.
Interesting.
Another provision, though, hey-ho. Now, this bill appeared Monday night, and it got voted on today. Some Republicans objected because they said there was no time to read it, which is perfectly true. But Taxpayers for Common Sense read it. Well, there was this provision requiring members of Congress and the administration to disclose what crop insurance subsidies they receive.
Whoa.
Yes, in the bill.
That's great.
It mysteriously was taken out in closed-door conference negotiations before it was released on Monday.
Oh. Jeez.
Yep.
Okay.
So they will not, we don't know who they are, and we don't know what they're getting, but we do know, according to Taxpayers for Common Sense, that some of the people getting these subsidies are actually on the conference committee.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Of course. I mean, we know that Michelle Bachmann is one of those people who's getting that. You know,
right. So that's
six figures.
Fascinating. So we don't have to hear who they are.
Yeah.
Prospects for the Senate to renew expired unemployment benefits picked up a bit today.
Hmm.
There's some bipartisan talks that seem to be happening. Majority Leader Harry Reid said he wants to hold a vote next week to revive the benefits. Democrats are pitching a new proposal that would extend long-term jobless aid through March and pay for it through changes to pension policy. Now, Republicans like their own bill, but they haven't said no.
Pay for it through changes to pension policies. What, federal workers' pensions?
Well,
or military pensions?
I've only been able to find three articles on this, and I've found no more detail than that yet.
Pensions of members of Congress?
I doubt that.
Doubt that, yeah, okay.
Doubt that.
All right.
One of the keys as to how successful this is likely to be is whether Reid allows Republicans to introduce amendments.
Right.
If he does, maybe this can happen. If he doesn't, it's going to get shut down again. But Reid says he has 58 or 59 votes. He only needs one more vote, and then he doesn't need to worry about offering amendments to Republicans.
Very interesting.
Congressional Republicans are responding to President Obama's State of the Union address thinking, what can we do about his use of executive power to sidestep Congress? Well, we can go to court, Senator John McCain said. We haven't got many more options except to tell the American people that we're seeing an abuse of the intent of the Constitution. And that's what many Republicans feel is the route that they need to go at this point in order to deal with what they feel is an abuse by the president. So,
is he suggesting that individual members can sue the president, or that, I mean, somebody has to have standing? I can see where the
right.
entire Congress could sue the executive branch, and that would immediately be thrown into the Supreme Court.
Right.
But I don't think you're going to get a majority of both the House and Senate to agree, or either body, to agree
to
sue the president.
That actually is the point that some lawmakers were saying, which is that they don't think that there's going to be the support to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though the Republicans control the House of Representatives, I'd be surprised if they got a majority vote to sue the president. Although, you know, you never know.
You never know. Representative Michael Grimm, Republican of New York, has apologized today for threatening a reporter from New York One News. After an interview after the State of the Union last night, after Michael Scotto had asked him about the State of the Union, he said he wanted to ask him about the corruption ethics investigation that's going on with Grimm. Grimm refused to answer him and stormed off. Let me be clear to you. If you ever do that to me again, I'll throw you off this effing balcony. And they were on the third floor of the rotunda.
Right. And he said, I'll break you like a boy.
This guy was
involved in a barroom altercation where he brought in an FBI agent and a bunch of local cops who were friends of his to go looking for a guy that he got in a fight with at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, he's got a long history of being pretty rough.
He has, and in fact, somebody else at New York One, like the program director, also says that he had a similar altercation to Scotto. So he does. He has there's a litany of this.
Yeah, this is just the first time it was on camera.
Yes.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yes.
What else is up?
It's very interesting indeed. Eric Holder, the attorney general, testified before Congress today and was asked about whether marijuana is harmful by Senator Jeff Sessions, because, of course, the president said last week that it's a bad habit and advice, not very different from smoking cigarettes. Holder said that he believes the use of any drug is potentially harmful. And
I wonder if he drinks coffee.
Ooh, now. Now.
Excuse me. Pardon me, I interrupted you in mid-sentence.
No, I was going to say that one of the Department of Justice's main enforcement priorities is preventing the distribution of marijuana to minors.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, you could say that about tobacco and alcohol as well. And that's not an unreasonable thing to say. But anyhow, thank you very much, Victoria.
Thank you so much.
It's always great seeing you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Coming up, the Republican conspiracy has worked. I'll tell you all about that right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Republicans should be thrilled with President Obama's State of the Union address. That's because the extremely limited vision of government he presented last night is pretty much what the Republicans plotted to create since day one of the Obama White House. In his fifth State of the Union address last night, you could say the president, you know, the essence of his message was whatever, right? He essentially said he's going to go it alone. His major policy plan for 2014 is to bypass Congress altogether. What do you do when, you know, Congress is not going to do their job? It's right there in the Constitution. This is what you do. No, we're not going to do that. He's going to say, okay, tough luck. I can get some things done. The executive branch does have some powers. Not a lot of powers, but they do. Well, actually, they have spying powers and military. Actually, he does have a lot of power. But not so much to help out average working people, right? Because he can't appropriate and spend money. So anyhow, as part of his plan for his so-called year of action, the president said he's going to issue an order all unilaterally raising the minimum wage for federal contract workers to $10.10 an hour. I mean, it's a nice start. Flurry of executive orders, it's better than nothing, but it's not the kind of bold change this country needs to undo the destruction caused by 33 years of Reaganomics. And somebody just needs to say that out loud. In the next few weeks, Republicans will no doubt say that Obama's plan to use his executive powers is proof that this guy is a tyrant and he's shredding the Constitution. Ignore their whining. A weakened president who has given up on pushing for broad reforms is exactly what the Republicans want. And they've been planning this moment since the day Obama took office. On January 20th, 2009, as Ellen Ratner and I were down at the Union Station dancing with Joe Biden and his wife and Barack Obama and his wife, it was the inaugural balls, right? Most Americans were out celebrating the end of the Bush years as much as they were the beginning of the Obama years. A group of powerful Republicans that very night was planning the end of the Obama presidency before it even really began. The Caucus Room Restaurant right here in Washington, D.C., down at the corner of, I think it's D and 9th. Republican leaders drew up a plan to intentionally sabotage President Obama at every point possible. The guest list, this was an invitation-only meeting. They had a private room. Republican Congressman Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren. That's from the House of Representatives. From the Senate, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. It was all orchestrated by Republican mastermind, propaganda mastermind Frank Luntz, and Newt Gingrich was there, too. Over the course of 4 hours, this group of the most powerful conservative lawmakers in the country committed to a plan of action. They promised each other that they would filibuster and obstruct any and all legislation supported by the new President Obama. Newt Gingrich came on my radio program last year, just a few months ago, actually, and actually bragged that the whole reason for the dinner was to come up with a plan to undermine President Obama. He said, hey, you know, we're the opposition. That's what you do. You oppose. Flash forward 5 years later. And it's pretty clear that that caucus room conspiracy has worked like a charm. Except for a brief period during his first year in office when the president pushed through health care reform and financial reform, Obama basically hasn't been able to get anything done. I mean, that first year, actually, he did get a lot done. But since then, he ended the Iraq War. That's a pretty big deal. And he's winding down Afghanistan. But Republicans have blocked his nominees. They filibustered his bills. They even shut down the government. All about, and we're going to defund Obamacare. Right. You know why this year's State of the Union address sounded like basically last year's State of the Union address? Because Republicans in Congress have made it pretty much impossible for President Obama to get anything done. Just this past year, they killed gun control, they sat on immigration reform, they froze efforts to raise the minimum wage, they refused to extend unemployment benefits. So basically Obama says, okay, that's it, screw it, I'm going to go it alone. I'm going to get things done with executive orders. He gave up. He all but said, you know, the caucus room conspiracy has succeeded. Right? Somewhere Frank Luntz is smiling. You know, I think progressives should, you know, in general principle, support the president as he works to make a year of action a reality. But we really need to be demanding more than just this small scale strategy. We should demand that the president call out Republican sabotage for what it is, a naked, shameless plan to protect the interests of the richest Americans at the expense of everyone else. This was this big debate back on January 20th. Josh Krauschauer, I believe it is, writing in the National Journal. About how, well, the headline says it all. Divided Democrats put Obama in a State of the Union squeeze. Liberals want the president to tackle income inequality. Moderates want him to focus on economic growth. What I think he needs to do is to match the Republicans point for point. He needs to do what Harry Truman did back in 1948 and call them out for being the party of special interests. But there's a very good chance that he's not, it's a certainty. He's not going to stick it to the GOP. He's not going to pull a Harry Truman. He's been in office for 5 years. And he's not been willing to really do that, you know, bully pulpit kind of politics like Harry Truman did and FDR did. I think part of this has to do with the president himself. At his core, he's not a bleeding blue progressive. He's a kind of a Clinton Democrat, kind of person Beltway types call a moderate. He'll support liberal causes. He'll bring the fight to the Republicans, but he's only going to do it when he's pushed hard enough. And that's where we come in. We the people. If we want President Obama to do more than just sign executive orders, if we want him to start calling out the Republicans, if we want him to be engaging in progressive policies, we have to start organizing from the ground up. And maybe it's not even going to be President Obama. Maybe it's going to be, you know, whoever's next. We need to do what the Tea Party did. Start taking over local political bodies, precinct committees. Take over the local political parties. We need to rally behind the Elizabeth Warrens of the country, the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party, people who can single-handedly shift the debate around issues like student loans and Social Security reform, because the stakes couldn't be higher. We're now more than halfway through the second two-term Democratic presidency in the past two decades. We should not be missing this opportunity. The demographics are shifting in favor of the progressives, but the country is still stuck in Reaganomics. And Republicans have, by and large, neutered this president, and there is still, you know, I still think there's a chance for real change, the kind that Obama promised when he first came to Washington. But that kind of change is only going to happen if we rally together, if we call out Republicans for conspiring to bring down the White House, the Obama White House, and if we push the president to the left. I mean, he may be, President Obama may be saying, oh, cool, you know, I got my year of action and we'll do a few little things here and there. I don't think that's enough. We need to be doing an inside-out strategy. The inside, get into political office, get into the party or parties, pick one. And the outside, join groups that are not associated with political parties and start getting active.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think if anything, the president's speech last night really told me it's a tag you're it moment for all the rest of us. And welcome back. Jerry, listening on WBAI in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Yeah, I'd like to talk about the President's State of the Union address yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two or three main concerns. One has to do with jobs and the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right,
you mentioned, and the other has to do with Social Security and Social Security checks and the private retirement accounts that President Obama mentioned. The other has to do with reforming unemployment insurance that the president vaguely made reference to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with respect to jobs, the president at one point in his speech, he mentioned lowering the corporate tax rates for businesses that make jobs here at home. But the problem is that then the president inconsistently keeps supporting and pushing for passage into law of these American job-losing trade deals, such as most recently now, this Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right.
They don't even have the decency.
Well, there's a good news, bad news story around that. I got an email last night from Lori Wallach, you know, and she's very, very, she kind of runs the opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and to the fast track thing. And she's with Public Citizen, I believe it is. And Lori is incredible. It wasn't a private email. It was a press release that her office sent out. I'm on the list. And basically what they said was, hey, you know, we're declaring victory. The president mentioned basically the legislation that will do fast track authority by name, but he just mentioned it in passing. And what everybody was afraid was going to happen was that he was going to spend four or five sentences on saying, you know, I want Congress to pass this bill and I want Congress to, you know, we need to restore fast track authority and we need to get this trade deal done and it's going to mean jobs and it's going to, you know, that he was going to sell it the way that Bill Clinton and George Bush sold, you know, free trade deals prior to now.
Well, he didn't do that.
Well,
he did use some of that language. He did say that it's making more jobs. And like you joked at one point, either earlier this week or last week, we'll make more jobs in other countries. Like
right.
Some of the free trade deals make more jobs in China. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would specifically...
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you, Jerry. And I would have preferred that he said, you know, these trade... You know, one of the things that we've learned from 32 years of Reaganomics is that free trade doesn't work. And so I'm pulling the plug. We're going to pull out of all of these trade deals, and we're going to go back to a tariff-based trade system. We're going to go back to what worked in the United States for over 200 years. He's not going to do that. You know, that's what I want him to do, but he's not going to do that. No, you know.
And with respect to Social Security, though, he says at one point, that's another concern of mine, he says the Social Security check is often not enough on its own for people to retire on. But then he goes on to say that, therefore, he'll call on the Treasury Department to create a new way for people to start up their own private retirement accounts.
Right.
That, to me, sounds an awful lot like the Social Security private retirement accounts plan of Republicans who want to privatize Social Security. So I think we need more elaboration on that and exactly what he means and what he's getting at there.
I want a lot of elaboration on that. You know, what's interesting is Fox News did a focus group after he was done. And they said, what do you all think about this MyRA, right? These individual retirement accounts that are going to use, apparently these government bonds are going to be issued by the Treasury Department for these. And they all said, we hate it. And then they said, it sounds terrible. And then they said, what do you know about it? And they all said, nothing. Don't have any idea what it is. But it came from Obama. We hate it. That was the Fox News focus group. So, Jerry, I share your concerns, but the devils will be in the details, and we don't know the details yet, so we're gonna find out. Thanks for listening to WBAI. Thanks for calling in. We'll be right back, 20 minutes past the hour. 20 minutes past the hour, exposing the con and conservative. Tom Harbin here with you. Linda in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on AM 1350. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Oh, nothing but the weather. Good weather here.
Okay. You wanted to talk about income inequality?
Yeah, you know, I always hear people say, your previous guest said, the two-family household is the cure for income inequality.
Yeah, this is, you know, Rand Paul. This was the speech that Rand Paul gave earlier today, too, where he said that let's cut benefits to women, especially single women who have more children. And actually, at one point in time, 23 states had rules like that, and it didn't work. And so now we're down to like 16 or 18 states that have rules like that. But Rand Paul is trying to recycle old Ronald Reagan ideas.
Yeah, well, you know, back in the 70s, I worked for a family and children's services for another state. And we were actively breaking up families. It went on before I started working there, and it went on after I left.
Yeah.
I was there for 3 years. It was in order to get income support or food stamps, the father could not be in the home. And nobody ever mentions that. This went on for years and years and years.
Yeah, but that is very much not the case now.
It's not the case now, but they're saying that in the 60s, they had a higher rate of families together, but especially black families.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was in the South, and what happened was these families would come in because my husband had lost his job or he had illness or accident or what have you, and we would have to tell him, we can help your family, but we can't help you, so you have to leave the home.
Right.
And if he didn't leave the home, they would be reported for fraud. And so he would eventually leave the home. And the longer this situation went on, the more, you know, dysfunctional the family got.
Yeah. Well, that is not a good policy. If what you're saying is true, Linda, and that's not a good policy. But what I can tell you is, and there's a good article about this over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, right now today, about this, you know, Rand Paul's proposal, is that when you look at the studies on families that are getting aid on single parents with aid and families and two parents who are getting aid based on their children, that their family size is no different than families that are not getting aid, number one. So it's a myth that people are having babies so that they'll qualify for welfare. Family size is identical. And secondly, that the probability of staying together or not staying together has nothing to do with the aid either. It may have something to do with poverty, but even that association is a fairly loose association. So, but you know, back in the 70s, I can't speak to it. I worked in social services in the from 78 to 83. I ran a community for abused kids, but we were dealing with severely abused children. I mean, kids who. I mean, the second kid that I did intake on that I was familiar with, his brother was starved to death in the basement by his father, and this kid had fetal alcohol syndrome, I wasn't seeing the we need welfare families. I was seeing the really really destructive families, the families where they were nearly killing their children or sometimes outright killing their children. But the times have changed a lot. Times have changed a lot. Linda, thank you for the call. Mark in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey. You were talking earlier about who had control of the House of Representatives.
Right. It looks like it was the first 2 years of Harry Truman, 46 to 48, and then 52 to 54, right?
Correct. Harry Truman became president in 45, and the second House of Representatives while he was president was controlled by the Republicans. The other three were Democratic control.
That's correct. And that was the do-nothing Congress. And then when Eisenhower came in, he brought with him a wave of Republican support, and the Republicans held the House for 2 years. And I just got a note from Harvey Kay, in fact, saying that for the next 6 years of the Eisenhower administration, the Democrats held the House. And Harvey said 1958 was a very, very progressive year, actually.
Yeah, it was the Republicans barely took control when he came in, 221 to 213.
Right.
And then in Eisenhower's last 2 years, the Democratic margin went to 283 to 151.
Yeah, huge. Yeah,
so
there you go.
It became progressively more Democratic as he was, as Eisenhower
and,
was.
And it stayed that way until the Clinton administration, until what was it, 94, I think it was, that that Gingrich was able to mobilize the Republicans with his contract on America and all that kind of thing. Mark, thank you for the correction and the clarification. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Tom in Aptos, California, you wanted to talk about the California Hemp Initiative?
Yes, it's the California Cannabis Hemp Initiative, and this is a legalization measure that someone called in before, but I have a new update for you that I think you're going to like.
Okay.
We're very much a grassroots organization. And we're in the process of gathering signatures right now to qualify for the November ballot.
Right.
And we have about 3 weeks to go. And to get us over the hump, what we've come up with is a single signature petition that any registered California voter can download from home, print out, sign, and mail in themselves.
And the website is?
The website is tinyurl.com/CCHI2014.
Okay, tinyurl.com/CC.
CCHI.
HI. So California Cannabis Hemp Initiative.
Yep. 2014
or 2014?
2014.
Okay, got it.
And what they need to do is download the file, save it to the computer first.
Right.
Print it out with the Adobe Acrobat.
Right.
Make sure it's printed full size, and then you can sign it, mail it in, and your signature will help us get on the ballot.
Assuming that you're a registered voter in the state of California.
Yes, registered in California.
Right. Okay. Tom, thanks a lot for the call, and hopefully we did some good with that. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Indeed. And one of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my new book, The Crash of 2016. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And the State of the Union address last night, we all heard it, or many of us did, saw it, heard it, all of the above. I think the president made a mistake in saying Congress chose not to do this, or Congress didn't do this, or if Congress won't do this. He should have said if the Republicans in Congress won't do this, if the Republicans won't do this. Because it's not like Congress is not doing things. I mean, Nancy Pelosi passed hundreds of pieces of really good legislation out of the House of Representatives that died because of Republican filibusters in the Senate. And the Senate in the years since then has passed, I don't know if it's hundreds, but certainly dozens of good pieces of legislation that never even got picked up in the House of Representatives once the Democrats took control of that. So in 2010. So, you know, put blame where blame actually resides, Mr. President, please. Because the American people, you know, they're not always paying such careful attention. They're busy. They're desperately trying to just, you know, get by, to make a living, to, as George W. Bush would say, put food on their families. I mean, you know, it's like, it's tough work. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening to KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Oh, how you doing, Professor? Listen, I decided to get involved, and I'm the self-appointed campaign manager for president for Mr. Eric Snowden. First of all, he has demonstrated integrity, a moral consciousness. He's not owned or committed to either party.
Did you see that Ed Snowden has actually been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize?
But sir, I'm talking about for president of the U.S. So
I understand. I understand. I don't think that's going to go very far. But the Nobel Committee...
Not with 2016, sir. Well, let's give it maybe three elections away.
Okay.
Snowden,
he's a young guy.
Probably a little bit. His name will probably be a little bit different than it is today, but he's my candidate because the other folks that you're offering seem to be committed to something. They're not free.
Right.
Mr. Snowden obviously is only committed to what's right.
So you're talking about like the election of 2024 or something like that, 2020, 2024. You know, by then, we may be able to look back and say, wow, that guy, you know, is it like, kind of like the way we look back on Daniel Ginsburg?
Absolutely.
Who's the Pentagon Papers guy?
Absolutely, I remember that, too.
Yeah.
But he's the only candidate that can really operate outside
the system
and really be able to affect the change in the system. What do you think?
Yeah, we'll see. I'm skeptical that Daniel Ellsberg, thank you. We'll see. I mean, if you're gonna run with it, Morris, keep me up to date. Let me know how.
I'm going to have to get other folks, and they're far more qualified than myself. Hazel Henderson, Elizabeth Warren. There are other folks. I'll just be the campaign manager. Get him in, and then I'll be able to have visits to the White House, perhaps.
Well, I think Elizabeth Warren has you know, there's people seriously talking about her in 2016 or 2020. And I think that there's a very, very good possibility. We will see where that goes. And if Hillary Clinton ends up the nominee and she were to pick Elizabeth Warren as her VP, that would be an astounding ticket. Anyhow, Morris, thanks a lot for the call. Matthew in Casanova, New York. What's up, Matthew?
Hello. My comment was on the caller you had who was talking about wage inequality, and he was suggesting that desire of people to be paid more is jealousy of the...
Oh, that was our guest an hour ago, yes, the professor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it just reminds...
Envy, actually, was the word he used. Yeah.
What?
Envy, I think, was the word he used, but, yeah.
Yes, but... And it just reminded me of how much the right is able to lead the narrative of discussion in this country on a number of issues. And with wage inequality... It's always framed as, you know, it's always the left having to argue a justification to tax and spend the rich people's money instead of the argument, why are we allowing the rich people to steal from the common people in mass? You know, we don't have a wage inequality problem in this country. We have an epidemic of thievery carried out by the 1% against the rest of us.
Yeah, and in large part, it is conducted legally, and it's done by buying politicians and thus buying laws, particularly tax policy laws, that benefit them very, very well. Thank you very much. And they can do that because the Supreme Court has said that money is the same thing as speech and is therefore protected by the First Amendment. And that corporations are the same thing as you and me, and therefore are protected by the 14th Amendment. And we need to overturn those things. Go to movetoamend.org. We need to, we need to blow up that doctrine. It's crazy stuff. Matthew, thank you. Good point. Eric in Springfield, Illinois. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
During your conversation about what you would want Obama to say and how to say it, like Harry Truman or Roosevelt. My comment on that is that, unfortunately, Obama's the first. And
he's the first black president?
First black anything, whether it was Jack Robinson or the first golfers. You cannot... show that type of aggressiveness. In the book, you know, that they wrote about Jackie Robinson's life, Rooney particularly picked him because of that he controlled himself.
Right.
Because Josh Gibson or Satchel Paige would have never, ever allowed somebody to throw black cats at him and make the comments they did out in the field.
Right.
So,
you know, I get that, Eric, when some Yahoo yells "you lie" out of the House gallery, you know, that Obama, President Obama, by, you know, being above that, by not taking the bait, by not even commenting on the lack of decorum or the bad manners. I get that when people are, throwing out thinly veiled racist statements. But on simple policy stuff, I'm not talking about they hate me and I welcome their hatred. As much as I love that statement from Eisenhower, FDR, I can't imagine Obama saying that. And I understand that. I think it's not part of his personality. But Why not identify the Republicans in Congress as the problem rather than Congress as the problem?
Well, that portion right there.
there are black Republicans.
I can understand your comments on that. But, I mean, he was elected. He was elected twice, okay?
Yeah.
But it's still...
And he's not running for re-election.
Yeah. Well, see, as a black man, I would have never taken none of that. That first one, you lie.
Yeah.
I would have stood right there, and I would have told him off.
Yeah.
Right in front of everybody.
Yeah.
Okay? And, of course, I probably wouldn't have gotten reelected.
Well, that's the point, and I understand what you're saying, because I remember the one time that the president used the word damn in an interview with, like, Morley Safer or somebody. It was one of those, 60-minute kind of interviews or one of the major news networks. This was about 3 years ago, I think, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And he said, I was, damn upset about that or whatever. And the headline on Drudge with a very darkened picture of President Obama was Obama goes street, right? Angry President Obama. And of course it was the angry black man, meme or whatever, the dog whistle to the white racists and, freak them out and all that kind of stuff. I get that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that identifying, pointing out that the Republicans actually got together and decided in an organized fashion that they were going to do everything they could to obstruct his presidency, not because of his race, but because of his party. Although, I think that some of them were motivated by his race. But I think the majority of them, they're motivated by the fact that, they're in the bag with the billionaires. I mean, it's just they're all in. And
yeah, well, I think Hillary, if she had got the nomination, would have faced some of the same.
I agree. I think misogyny is just as alive and well in America as racism is.
Now, the next one, okay, and I know there's going to be another black president. The gentleman from Newark, Cory Booker, is that his name? He may not be as nice.
Right. He can take names and kick ass.
Yeah, because, see, now we got through that first one.
Right.
Okay. And but
there's still that. I mean, look at how long we've had black athletes. I mean, Muhammad Ali, even before that, and yet Richard Sherman goes off on TV, and all of a sudden everybody's using the word thug, as short for the N-word. I mean, it's still with us. Even the second African American president is going to face that.
But I think he could probably. Weather it.
Yeah, I think you're right, Eric. It's an interesting dynamic, and it's really a tragedy that racism and sexism play such a large role in our body politic. It's really a tragedy. Eric, thank you for the call, and thanks for calling for listening in Springfield, Illinois.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Quite literally, Abraham Lincoln's hometown, wasn't it? Springfield, Illinois? I think he was born there. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And George, listening on WBAI in... How do you pronounce that city in New York?
It's Copaig. It's an Indian name.
Copaig.
I just want to speak a little bit about the Supreme Court Citizens United case. And I was thinking about it, and I thought of a good way that we might be able to fight back. And I was thinking, because... if they're saying that money is speech, then what's to stop me from, say, donating $100 to Al-Qaeda? I mean, at that point, you can't say I can't, because if I can legitimately, illegally say I support Al-Qaeda, then why can't I donate $100 to it?
It's an interesting question. I think that there are some limitations probably on how legally you can say that you support them, although I... you could go back to the Skokie Nazi trial, where the Supreme Court said that, even the Nazis have the right to demonstrate in a Jewish neighborhood.
Right. I mean, this is a way to say, hey, this is the extreme that you put us into.
Right.
At this point, anybody can donate to whomever they like, even if they're clearly against the American people.
Right, right. Well, we've got a situation right now where if Al-Qaeda wanted to support a particular political candidate, they could probably get away with it.
Right.
And
so, vice versa. It's very important that we try to get the money out of these politics and so that we control our laws and say money isn't speech and,
right.
Prevent even assisting a terroristic group.
Right. Very, very interesting. George, thanks for the call. Thanks for the thought-provoking comment. I'll mull that one over. Peggy in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, Peggy, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to underscore what a lady said a few calls back.
Mm-hmm.
She said she was in the South, and she realized that she was a social worker, I think, and she realized that black men had to leave their families.
In order to qualify for assistance.
In order for the mother to get assistance for her children.
Right.
I'm an African-American from Ohio, and I was in graduate school at the University of Chicago, and I worked in a program, and I became aware of exactly that fact,
mm-hmm.
that the black husbands had to leave their families, and he could have, had some terrible accident on his job or been fired or just come from somewhere, and they didn't have jobs where he came from. But I saw exactly that. And the women would say they will come in the middle of the night and look under the bed to make sure that the husband is not present.
Whoa.
So have we...
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing that those policies are gone.
Well, but it's done great devastation to the black family.
Yeah.
That went on for a long time. No other group has had to undergo that kind of horror.
Well, I would guess that probably poor white people had the same problem, didn't they? I mean, this was not race-specific.
So, only black people were put in those public housing projects in Chicago. The poor whites somehow were, allowed to live in neighborhoods and in private homes or whatever.
Oh, very
interesting.
Only
the blacks were stacked in the projects, so.
Very interesting.
What about that?
Well, that was back when you had redlining. That was
It goes on today, Tom, but I won't go into that. I just wanted to make sure that you knew because you said if that happened.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. Jimmy Carter signed the legislation that outlawed redlining, and several years after that, Louise and I moved to Atlanta, and the real estate agent said to Louise, do you want to look at white neighborhoods or mixed neighborhoods? And Louise said, I don't want you as my real estate agent. And, literally, that's what happened. It's still going on. It is absolutely still going on. Peggy, thank you for the call. And thanks for the heads up on this. And thanks for listening to KPFK. We'll be right back. Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Harbin here with you, and welcome back. Cliff in Eastlake, Colorado, listening on AM 760 in Denver. Hey, Cliff, you wanted to disagree with me, it says here?
Yeah. How you doing?
Good. Go for it.
Okay, so minimum wage, right? Say someone has a convenience store and they employ 3 people, and say they, just to make it easy, they earn $7 an hour, right?
Right.
And those 3 people work 100 hours a week combined.
Right.
So that's
33 hours
$100
each.
A month.
Yeah.
Is that right? $2,800. Now, if you raise it $3, say you take it up to 10, now all of a sudden that guy's payroll, a small business, has now jumped by $1,200 a month.
Right.
So he's in business not to to satisfy government or to make other people wealthy. He's in business like all capitalists, including yourself, because you're a capitalist, right? Because you set up businesses.
I am not a capitalist. I am an entrepreneur. There's a difference. Well, I don't make a living capital.
There's three forms of capital. There's money, human energy, and equipment and physical capital. So if you set up any business, you are a capitalist because you have to have some formation.
By your definition, not by my definition.
Well, that is the definition of capitalism if you read Milton Friedman.
Yeah, I'm no fan of Milton Friedman.
So that guy who's just now taken a loss of $1,200 a month, how is he supposed to recoup that?
Well, your premise is that the guy who's running this convenience store at $7 an hour, he's paying wages, that his principal goal is to make money. That's all well and good, but the reality is that he is operating a business. When you operate a business in the United States, or anywhere in the world for that matter, typically you are given special treatment under tax laws, and you're given limitations of liability under corporate charter laws. You get a whole lot of benefits from the government. The reason why we, the people, give business people like me or like that 7-Eleven guy, give them benefits is because the presumption is that by conducting business, we will do something that will accrue benefit to society. Now, if you're running a business in a way that doesn't benefit society, you should not be running that business.
If a guy's running a legitimate business, and if you can just answer the question, and he's now taking a loss of $1,200 a month, he's either going to
if he cannot run his business in a way that benefits society. If he cannot run his business and pay a reasonable wage, then he's got a lousy business model, and he doesn't deserve to be in business.
If it's paying minimum wage, which is the legal wage at the moment, it's quite within his rights to do that.
That's correct.
It's none of your business or anyone else's business what he does. So if
it, well, actually, it is my business, and it is your business. We're part of society. He's part of society. He's using the infrastructure that we're paying for.
This is the difference of philosophy. You believe that. I don't. I believe that if you go into business and you put your capital up for risk and you're going to create jobs and create opportunities for that person's family, now all of a sudden your payroll is going up $1,200 a month. How is he going to get that back? That's the third time I've asked you that. How is he supposed to get that money back?
There's a whole variety of ways that you can do that. When you increase people's wages, and I've done that with this radio show. The people that are working with me right now are making a whole lot more than the people who started out with me. In fact, when Rama started out with me way back in the day, the first 2 years, I took no pay at all, and my earliest employees were working for very, very little. And over time, you change your business model as opportunities become possible. I would say that this guy should either take less pay himself or cut back on other expenses or raise his prices. I mean, there's a whole variety of things he can do. But the fact of the matter is, please don't try to filibuster me if you actually want an answer to your question. If you actually want an answer to your question, filibustering me is not going to get it for you. If this guy actually wants to be in business, and the minimum wage law has gone up, he's not the only person affected by it. All of his peers are affected by it. So everybody is going to have to adjust their business models. And look around you right now. Everybody has adjusted their business models to accommodate the minimum wage. In fact, I would say that Walmart and McDonald's have adjusted their business model to not only accommodate the minimum wage, but to accommodate the welfare reforms in the late 90s, so that now we are supporting their employees. I think that's a lousy business model, too. Back to you, Cliff.
Sam, as I said before, I guess I was on hold there, right?
I think Shane potted you down because you wouldn't stop talking.
Okay. Yeah, well, I was trying to get a word in. But anyway, the point is that if you set up a business, contrary to people like Mr. Obama, who has never ran a business in his life, so he has kind of no idea what he's doing, you go into business to make money, and capitalism is the only form of economic activity that we know of to date. There could be something else down the line that can drag people from very meager means, and in fact,
that's simply not true.
It's absolutely true.
Cliff, this is simply not true. Have you never heard of cooperatives?
Warren Buffett.
Go look at Mondragon in Spain. They're doing $50 billion a year in business. They're not capitalists. It's,
of course they're capitalists.
No, they're owned by their employees.
You don't understand the meaning of capital, Tom. You're thinking it's just money.
Okay.
You just think it's cash. Capitalism is not just cash, not sitting.
I am saying my definition of capitalism differs from Milton Friedman's, apparently. My definition of capitalism, or a capitalist, is a person who lives off capital.
True capitalism, the real understanding that people should know, there's three forms: human energy, physical capital, and money. Everyone knows that. Anyone who's studied any economics knows that's just how free money
operates. I'm familiar with that model, but for the purposes of our tax code, I don't get to say, oh, I'm only going to, when I take a paycheck out of this company, I pay up to 39%. I pay, because I don't have the luxury that Mitt Romney has of saying, oh, I'll pay a maximum of 20% because I'm taking capital. Right. So it just doesn't work. So I'm talking in the context of the real world, not in the context of Milton Friedman. Coming up tomorrow, I'll talk with Congressman Alan Grayson, Democrat from the 9th District of Florida, about the State of the Union, as well as his latest efforts to fight the TPE. Plus, we'll be talking Issues of the Day with Attorney Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio. And, you know, liberals hate the middle class. Fred Siegel's going to tell us all about that.
Right.
Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.